Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. Stay tuned now for Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer.
This is Thomas Young, and you're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Was it hard for you to open up?
Initially, yes, but it got to the point where it began to dawn on me that if we show as much of what I go through as we can, the more the viewing public and hopefully the 18, 19, 20-year-old kids, males especially, because we deal with a lot of things that men may not want to think about. The more information they would have to see the ramifications and consequences of what a hasty enlistment would cause. Because everybody joins with the knowledge that they may not come back at all. But I doubt very many, I know I certainly didn't, think that they would come back in a far diminished capacity, in a wheelchair or in a, you know, amputated, anything.
Yeah, I'd like to see a copy, a DVD of this film go out to every student who's touched by a recruiter with video games and other information that balance out the information.
With any luck, I will be going on a campus tour with the film and doing question and answer sessions and giving speeches all around the country.
Well, keep us posted on that.
I hope that this this movie and this CD will serve as valuable counter recruitment tools.
I write this letter on the 10th anniversary of the Iraq War, on behalf of my fellow Iraq veterans. I write this letter on behalf of the 4,488 soldiers and Marines who died in Iraq. I write this letter on behalf of hundreds of thousands of veterans who have been wounded and on behalf of those who bear those wounds. I am one of the gravely injured. I am paralyzed from in an insurgent ambush in 2004 in Sauter City. My life's coming to an end.
Today on Tell Somebody, Mark Wilkerson talks about his new biography, Thomas Young's War. Stand by for Tell Somebody.
I speak for a man who gave for this land, took a bullet in the back for his pain.
Hello, and welcome to Tell Somebody for March 24th, 2016. This is the last regularly scheduled weekly edition of the show. I'll have a few more words to say about that if there's time at the end of the show. But note that the following links will persist and continue, so keep an eye on www.tellsomebody.us. On Twitter, at Tell Somebody Now. Like the Facebook page, www.facebook.com/tellsomebodynow. Comments or questions, send an email to mail@tellsomebody.us. This is your host, Tom Clammer. In October 2005, I met Iraq war veteran Thomas Young sitting in his wheelchair at an anti-war vigil on the plaza in Kansas City. And very soon after that, I went to his home and sat at a round table with him and recorded an interview for one of my first Tell Somebody shows. Paralyzed by a sniper's bullet in 2004 in Iraq, Thomas struggled with severe pain and setback after setback for 10 years and died in Seattle on November 10, 2014. At the memorial gathering for Thomas in Kansas City a few days later, his mother introduced me to Mark Wilkerson, who was writing a biography of Thomas. It had become increasingly apparent to me in the last year or so that I just couldn't continue to meet a weekly show deadline for much longer. But when I heard a few months ago that the biography of Thomas would be released this spring, I decided I didn't want to quit the show before I could do one with Mark Wilkerson about Thomas Young's war. Unlike U.S. politicians and journalists and media talking heads who suffered no consequences, many other people suffered severe consequences of the journalism failure leading to the Iraq War. Phil Donahue wanted to tell us about the thousands of U.S. military personnel and their families who suffered such consequences. And the example he was lucky to come upon happened to be an extremely charismatic and bright soldier named Thomas Young. I believe people need to know about Thomas Young. Mark Wilkerson spent 8 years in the U.S. Army as an AH-1 Cobra and UH-60 Black Hawk helicopter crew chief with the 3rd Infantry and the 101st Airborne Divisions. He was deployed with the 101st to Mogadishu, Somalia for 6 months in 1993. Mark has 3 children, Alex, Nick, and Sam. He lives in Louisville, Kentucky with his wife, Melissa. Thomas Young's War is his 3rd book. I reached Wilkerson by telephone on Friday and recorded this conversation. Give a listen. Mark Wilkerson, welcome to Tell Somebody.
Thank you, Tom. I really appreciate you having me on.
Your book, Thomas Young's War, is just about to come out. How did you first hear about Thomas Young leading to deciding to write a book about him?
Well, the first time I heard about Thomas was back in 2007, before the Body of War film came out. I was working on my first book, which was about the guitarist for The Who, Pete Townsend. And I had approached Eddie Vedder, the lead singer for Pearl Jam, to write the foreword to the book, because I knew he was a big fan of Pete Townsend. And at the same time that Eddie was working on the foreword to my book, he was also working on a couple of songs for the Body of War film. So that's how I first became aware of who Thomas was and his story. So obviously the following spring, when the film was publicly available, I watched it with a great deal of interest. But then, you know, I think as with most of us, at the end of the film, I almost felt kind of reassured in a way, because Thomas had figured out how to cope with his injury. He'd found purpose in his life as an activist, and people listened to him. So it was a reasonably upbeat end to a very tragic story when the film ended. But I heard nothing for about 5 years, and then what became known as The Last Letter came out in early 2013, just 5 years after the film had come out. And that was the next thing that I'd heard of Thomas, and I was just amazed. Looking at photos of him that accompanied the articles about the letter that he'd written, and also obviously about his decision to end his life, that he was planning on ending his life in April of 2013 after his first wedding anniversary. And I was just amazed that I had so many questions. What happened in those 5 years? What on earth had happened to this guy and to make him look probably 15 years older and to make him reach a point where he didn't want to live anymore, and he was on hospice care and in excruciating pain and everything. I managed to track down his email address, and I got in touch with him, and I thought, you know, I want to know what happened, and I know many other people want to know what happened, and it's a story that people need to hear. And I got in touch with Thomas, and he agreed. He wanted people to know his story. So pretty quickly after that, probably within a week or 10 days, I was out of his house for the first visit, which was about 3 days, and spent some time getting to know him and started doing interviews for the book. So it was a pretty quick turnaround once I realized what was going on with him.
And so you first met him after he'd written his letter?
Yeah, it was in April of 2013. It was a week before his wedding anniversary, and the wedding anniversary was April the 20th. So it was around like the 13th of April that year.
Wow. But you do tell the whole story of his life in this book, though, right?
Absolutely. What I tried to do in the book is mix it up a little bit, as far as I tell some of the backstory of his childhood and growing up, and obviously 9/11, him signing up for the military, all the way through his experience in Iraq and his injury and his return, his time at Walter Reed, his time at Jefferson Barracks in St. Louis, coming home, the whole experience of his life. And then I intersperse along the way my visits with him several times at Kansas City, and also later on he moved to Portland, Oregon at the end of 2013. He moved to Portland, and I went out and visited him there, too. So I mix in those visits because there was a pretty significant process that took place there, too, because the first time I met Thomas was, like I said, it was pretty soon after he had announced that he wanted to end his life. And he was planning on ending his life within weeks of me being there that first visit. But my next visit was the following month, and then my next visit was a couple of months later, and he began to defer his decision to die, and he began to, you know, the clouds kind of parted a little bit, and he started seeing, you know, different reasons to not end his life. So there was a big shift there that I was right there, had a front row seat for. So I kind of have, there's two almost parallel stories going on at the same time in the book, with the backstory and then with my, you know, my visits.
Yeah, and he was such a fighter throughout all of this. You know, when he decided to write that letter and then rethought his decision to end his life, then he was dealing with some major challenges of pain and VA help and so forth. What did you see of what he was dealing with in that regard at that time?
When I first met him, I mean, I've had a pretty... I don't think I've led a very sheltered existence or anything, but I've never been around anybody with a spinal cord injury, anybody in a wheelchair, anybody who's on a feeding tube or into hospice care or dealt with any of this stuff, or anybody that's had to face, like, end-of-life decisions and things like that. And it was just all of that in one, you know, all on top of each other. When I first saw Thomas, he was in the hospital bed. His legs were just, you know, skin and bone, basically. He'd been paralyzed for 9 years by the time I had seen him, paralyzed from the chest down by the time I first met him. He was on a feeding tube. He had had a colostomy, so he had a colostomy bag. He had a catheter. He was on a pain pump. So all kinds of tubes and wires all over the place. His speech had been degraded by an anoxic brain injury because he'd had a pulmonary embolism. His hands had basically no grasp as a result of that same brain injury. Just a thousand complications, all from stemming from this original spinal cord injury 9 years before. So, and he was dealing with chronic pain issues, getting the right kind of care from the VA as far as pain management, a million side effects from this whole list of medications he was on. And somehow, you know, somehow through all of that, through all the stuff that he was on, was this guy that was still felt very much betrayed at what he'd been sent to do in the war. He was very sharp and a very acute awareness of, like, current events, like, way better than me. And I'm not on, you know, I wasn't taking morphine and Dilaudid and all these other really heavy-duty painkillers. And he still had a sense of humor. He was still a, you know, smart-ass, sarcastic, just his personality was still coming through, all of that. And that just amazed me.
Yeah, I was kind of shocked at seeing some of the pictures of him that made it onto social media and into the papers when he wrote the letter, and in months around that time, you know, with the big beard that I didn't remember him having when I last saw him. And he just looked like such a tired, worn out, and hurting old man.
Yeah, at 33 years of age.
Yeah.
Yeah, but and then, just a few years after the movie had come out, it was a huge difference in such a short time. And that was, like I said, that's one of the things that made me go, what on earth happened in the interim? I mean, it really made me think, you know, Body of War was a great film and a great document of what had happened, but it was just act one, you know, of this whole tragedy.
Yeah. I don't know if you saw it and had the same reaction or not, but I think it was this year, just within the last couple of months, his mother, Kathy Smith, posted a picture on Facebook that she said was the last picture she had taken of him the last time she visited him in the Northwest. And, you know, he had the big beard, and it was just days or weeks before he died. But somehow to me, it looked like there's that happy little boy face in there somehow. That just really struck me. I don't know if it was just how it looked to me, but somehow that was still alive in him.
Well, you know, the last time I saw him was in Portland in his apartment, and it was and I talk about this in the book. It was the, I don't know, maybe the fifth or sixth visit I'd had with him over those 2 years, like each one a couple of days long, and that last time he'd had a haircut, he'd trimmed the beard up a little bit, and he put on a little bit of weight, which was a very good development, and he was really upbeat. And I say in the book, you know, that's the first time that I had, during the time that I'd known him, that I could actually kind of see the Thomas from the film, you know, in there. He didn't have his sunken cheeks, and he didn't have what his wife Claudia referred to as the thousand-yard stare. There was a little bit more, you know, of the old Thomas back. So it was really good to see.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't want to get off track too far too long, but I couldn't help wondering in reading your bio that you, let's see, where is it here? Spent 8 years in the Army as a helicopter crew chief, including 6 months in Mogadishu, Somalia in 1993. That was the year of Black Hawk Down, wasn't it?
Right. I left. So I got to Somalia, I think, in April of 93, and I left about 2 weeks before the Black Hawk Down incident happened. Those guys were the guys that came in to relieve us. So I was there during, like, when I first got there, it was pretty open as far as we could drive down the streets, and we could, actually, we initially moved, we were based further inland, not in Mogadishu, but as the weeks passed, they started to consolidate because things started happening. We were part of like a UN peacekeeping force. There were Pakistani troops there. There were Malaysians, Romanians. There were Russian civilians there. Bunch of Italians, Canadians, bunch of different nationalities. And some things started happening. I remember like 20 Pakistani troops got killed like in the summer. And we started having to kind of consolidate down to Mogadishu, and then as the summer went on, that we were getting attacked with mortars and rocket propelled grenades and just small arms fire pretty much every night. So we weren't allowed to drive anywhere. It was all helicopters all the time, basically. So we did a lot of flying, a lot of getting shot at. I didn't really, I didn't see anything firsthand. So it was a very, as far as any, you know, firsthand combat. It was just, you know, sometimes we'd come back and there'd be a few bullet holes in the helicopter, but so it was nothing compared to what happened later, and it was nothing compared to what probably 99% of the guys and girls that went over to Afghanistan and Iraq saw. But I think it was enough. First of all, my time in the military was enough for me to maybe have that kind of link with Thomas, and then just a little tiny taste of what it's like to be in the middle of the other side of the world, right in the middle of something that's just making small headlines back home, to really make me, you know, it makes you kind of contemplate things in, maybe in a different way than you ever did before.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to ask you about, how, you know, with your experience in the Army, Thomas didn't have a long military career. It was pretty intense in a short time. I guess he had enlisted before 9/11 and didn't get very far before a medical discharge because of a shoulder problem or something. But he enlisted again 2 days after 9/11 and was only in Iraq for, what was it, less than a week when he was shot, right?
Yeah, 5 days. He spent a couple of weeks in Kuwait, staging there and waiting for their equipment to come over by sea. And then he was in Iraq for 5 days, and that little the very short ride that he was in the back of that truck where he was shot was his first time out of the base, basically, since he got there.
Yeah, now I was just kind of wondering how your experience in Army helped you relate to them and write this book, as you suggested. You know.
Yeah, I don't know as far as our experience. You know, I was 11 years older than Thomas, so different kind of generation military-wise. I was actually in training during the first go-around in Iraq in 1991, so I didn't go over there. But so my only taste of combat was in Somalia. So we didn't have, you know, we had the military experience in common. We were both enlisted, so kind of had that in common. As far as I remember us talking about our families, like the support our family, or lack thereof, that our families received while we were overseas, which in my experience is pretty common for enlisted guys. They're kind of, I don't know, we were never part of like the social network. So, you know, while I was over in the States. So when we deployed, I think it's a different experience for the officers' families than it is for the enlisted families. We were kind of, my wife never had any clue what was going on. And a lot of the enlisted wives would call each other and kind of wonder what was going on. And I'm not sure that was the same for the officers. So I know we definitely talked about that. And, you know, some of the terminology, he didn't have to explain things to me because I knew it. But pretty different experience based on the fact that our enlistments were probably, you know, 10 years apart, 12 years apart.
Yeah. As you were saying earlier, at the end of the film, it was, you know, kind of an uplifting thing. He had suffered this terrible, tragic, overwhelming injury that dramatically changed his life, but still there was a positive thing. I remember one of the last protests in Kansas City I saw him at, he did have people who saw the movie, they might remember one address he gave in a church where he had to bend over in his chair. He couldn't regulate his temperature and his breathing and so forth, and he had an episode like that at this outdoor protest, and he had to not give his talk that he planned, but still, all things considered, he was pretty high functioning. He was very articulate in his speech. He had control of his hands, and I'd like to play a little clip here that I talked to him on the phone just a week or two after the film debuted in Kansas City.
All right.
Thomas Young, welcome back to Tell Somebody.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
I got the chance to have just a real quick word with you last Tuesday at the premiere of the film Body of War in Kansas City. I understand you were just down in Texas for a film festival. Is that right?
I'll actually be going down there on the 12th of March.
Oh, that's still coming up.
Right. South by Southwest is... they're screening the movie and having a concert in conjunction with the screening because there's also a Body of War companion album. It's not really a soundtrack, but it's songs that I personally selected, anti-war and all kinds of other protest songs. So several of the artists from that album are going to be down there in Austin as well.
Oh, great. I was going to ask you about the CD album a little later, but let's talk about that right now. We heard a little bit about that from Ellen Spiro. Tell us about that CD.
Oh, well, it's as eclectic as my musical tastes go. There's anything from John Lennon and Neil Young to some undiscovered little known acts like Blow Up Hollywood and Immortal Technique. That compilation is not really a lot of it's not a lot of flowers and hugs music. It's meant to incite anger and you know, rage within the set a fire in the belly of the person who's listening into it, hopefully.
And as I think you just said, it's not actually a soundtrack. It's a lot of songs that don't all appear in the movie, but
right. I came up with the CD idea after the movie had been. The shooting of the movie had been wrapped.
But it does have, what is it, two Eddie Vedder songs that are in the movie?
It only has one of the two Eddie Vedder songs that he wrote for the movie, because the other song is called, there's the anti-war anthem No War that is performed on the CD by him and Ben Harper from Lollapalooza. And then there's another song that he wrote called Long Night, which dealt with my divorce and my subsequent recovery from it, that doesn't really fit the anti-war protest mode. Also has a song by a man named Michael Franti called Light Up Your Lighter, which has a very almost prophetic lyric in Why Do Veterans Get... Here's what you get, an M16 and a Kevlar vest. You might come home with one less leg, but this thing will surely keep a bullet out of your chest, which certainly wasn't the case in my situation.
Were you not wearing a vest, or it didn't work?
No, I was wearing a vest, but it didn't keep the bullet out of my chest, mm-hmm. or shoulder, as it were.
Last week on the show, we replayed the interview you gave me in the fall of 2005.
It's been that long already? Wow.
Yeah, time flies, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And got a lot of comments from that interview. But I remember, I think you said something to the effect that there was a lot of good people trying to do good work in the Veterans Administration, but they were just stretched kind of thin. And I believe this was before the big flap in the major media about Walter Reed hospital problems.
Right.
And I've also talked on the show to a Marine who was at Fallujah and to the wife of another serviceman who were frustrated with the problems with the VA. What's your take on how the media has handled this and anything else you want to say about the VA?
I feel like a lot of things pertaining to the war and the treatment of veterans afterwards, I think the media has, in large part, dropped the ball by undercovering things. I mean, again, there's also a certain wall of secrecy, as it were, with the VA. Nobody really likes their dirty laundry to get aired out in public. Those were a couple of problems that I ran into a couple times with trying to get cameras into the VA.
At that time, he was up about the film and the album. I remember him talking about wanting to do anti-recruiting at colleges. He seemed to have a purpose, and with all the things he was dealing with already then, there was still this positive fight and a desire to be heard and make a difference.
Yep, and I mean, it's just amazing. That was March of 2008, I think.
I believe.
Within 2 months, later was when he had his pulmonary embolism, and his ability to speak was severely degraded to the point where, well, at first, you know, he could really not speak at all, like in the months immediately after, but even after months of therapy and just effort, it was so difficult to understand him if you tried to talk to him over the phone. You know, he lost his ability to be an effective speaker was, if not completely taken away from him, you know, a huge part of it was taken away from him. It was endlessly frustrating for him, for his family, you know. So it's like as soon as the film came out, that Thomas was no longer, it was no longer there.
Yeah, I remember the last time I saw him in person, as I was telling you off air earlier, was while he was in the intensive care unit at St. Luke's in Kansas City. Memory's a little fuzzy, but I think that Sunday maybe after it happened, I ran into Dr. Yolanda Hewitt Vaughn on the plaza, and we decided to go see him. We went up to ICU, and it was just so heartbreaking. As you said, he lost a lot of ability to speak and use of his hands, and it was just terrible to see him laying there. But there was still hope at that point. And I've got just one more clip I want to play. A few days after that, I talked to his mother, Kathy Smith, while he was still in St. Luke's. And let me just cue that up here. Kathy Smith, welcome to Tell Somebody.
Thank you.
A lot of us heard Friday night via Bill Moyers, those of us that could see it. It was preempted by KCPT, but there was a notice on there that your son had gone into the hospital. Could you tell us what happened?
Well, a week ago Friday, we found Thomas in a comatose state. He was not breathing correctly, and he had a blood clot that had moved from his right arm into his lung, and he was in a coma for several hours overnight, and when he came to, he was very disoriented, couldn't speak. He was on a ventilator for 2 days, and when he finally came off of the ventilator, he was doing very much better, and then after 2 days, he developed, we think it was from an infection in his lung. He had a backslide and became very incoherent and couldn't communicate, and so he was moved back into ICU, which he is now out of ICU. At this point, we believe he is out of danger, and he is going to recover. He has all of his mental facilities, remembers everything, has no problem with words or pictures. His problem right now is speech. He is having trouble communicating, and a little bit of fine motor skills. His arms and hands are very weak. But other than that, we think he's going to be fine. I would like to take a moment and thank, first of all, everyone that came out to the plaza on Sunday and their wonderful vigil and the posters that everyone made. That was just wonderful. And I would also like to thank everyone who has sent cards and letters. The hospital has been just inundated with cards and letters from Thomas all over the country, and quite a few from right here in Kansas City. And it's been just wonderful. And Thomas absolutely knows how much everyone cares about him and wants him to get better. So that's been very big. I think that's been a very big part of his recovery. Just knowing that so many people care about him, that's really helped a lot.
Well, that's good to hear, and it must be a huge relief to know how he's doing now.
Oh, absolutely. It was very scary the first day that the pulmonary doctor came in and said that he had a 50-50 chance of even coming out of the coma.
Wow.
And then that if he did, there would be significant brain damage because he had been with, not without oxygen, but with less oxygen than he should have had for probably 8 or 10 hours. So we didn't know what to expect when he came out of the coma, but it's been very much better than we thought it was going to be. Certainly still serious, and he is going to spend a good amount of time in rehab to get back to where he was, which it's you know, it's very disheartening because it's not fair. Thomas has been through enough already.
More than enough. Yeah. It's hard to imagine going through what he's been through.
Yeah, it's not right that he has to go back into rehab and learn how to talk again. It's certainly more than he needs, but I tell you what, he's a fighter. He'll get through this. If anybody can make it through this, Thomas can.
Yeah.
And he still has a lot to fight for, so, you know, 6 months, a year from now, he'll be out pounding the pavement again. By then, we'll have a new president.
There may be some good news on that front.
Exactly, yeah. One of the first things that he told me after he was able to communicate again was that he was voting for Obama.
Okay, well, the wheels are turning in there, huh?
Absolutely.
When I saw you Sunday at the plaza, Ellen Spiro was there. I heard that Phil Donahue had come. He's made an impact on these people, hasn't he?
Oh, absolutely. They both flew in just to give their support for no other reason, just to fly in and let Thomas know that they love him.
And he's still going to be at St. Luke's for a while if people want to send cards?
Yes. He is still at St. Luke's, and we're not sure how much longer he'll be there.
Mm-hmm.
Probably several days anyway, mm-hmm. until we get all the rehab figured out. And he's not totally medically stable yet, so we don't want to rush anything, because the last time they moved him out of ICU, he was right back into ICU. So
yeah,
he wants to go home. He thought for some reason he was going home today.
Mm-hmm.
But he is still at St. Luke's, so if anybody wants to send cards, letters, that's fine. But I know everybody's out there praying for him and thinking about him, and that helps a lot.
And I understand your son, Nathan, you just talked to him a day or two ago. How's he doing?
He's doing well.
And
he's
for our listeners that maybe don't know, your next oldest son is in Iraq right now.
Yes. He's got 6 months left on his second deployment. This is his second tour in Iraq. And this was the 15-month long one, so this has been a long time to hold my breath. But he's got 6 months left this time, and then he'll be home, and hopefully he will be out of the Army unless they call him back. He'll be in an active reserve, so hopefully this will be the last time we have to go through this.
We talked about Thomas being through a lot. I know you've been through a lot with all of this, too, and certainly glad to hear that he's doing better.
Yes, I am too. I actually have finally come home today for a little while. I feel like I've spent the last 9 days at the hospital almost all the time. So. Mm-hmm. But I have a 9-year-old, and he's at home today, and so I thought, you know, I spread myself pretty thin, but I thought he needed a little bit of mom too today. So.
Well, we certainly appreciate your taking a few minutes to update us on that.
Again, thanks to everybody that sent wonderful cards and letters from all over the country and from right here in Kansas City, and to keep up the good thoughts and the good karma, and I think he's going to be just fine.
Okay. Well, best wishes to you and your family and Thomas, and hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you so much.
This is Tom Clamer. You're listening to Tell Somebody. That was the voice of Thomas Young's mother, Kathy Smith, speaking in 2008 when Thomas Young was in the hospital after having an embolism. And on the phone is Mark Wilkerson, author of the new biography about Thomas Young, Thomas Young's War, coming out in just a couple of weeks. So keep an eye out for that, and we'll get to some information about where to look for that. But Mark Wilkerson, I don't know, for me that's heartbreaking to listen to again, because there was this hope that he would be able to rehab back to the level of function that he was before this setback, and that never happened, did it?
Yeah, absolutely. There was a lot of hope in Kathy's voice there that he would be back, you know, pounding the pavement, he'd be back to the way he was before. And obviously at that point, he must not have been out of the woods yet, because, I mean, there was memory loss. There were significant speech issues, and he had no grasp with his hands. So, there were a lot of issues there, and that he never recovered from. And some of the issues led to further complications down the road. So it was the beginning of a whole series of complications that went on over the next several years that led to that last letter and led to the his going on hospice care and wanting for a period to take his own life. It was that unbearable.
Yeah. I guess from St. Luke's, he went to rehab in Chicago, and Let me back up just a little bit. From early on, since he was first wounded, there were VA issues, a mixed bag. You know, he talked about some of the wonderful people at the VA doing the best they could, but there were always problems, and there were some problems. You know, he had just tried to get something looked at the VA before they found him unconscious in his home, right?
Yeah, the issue with the embolism started, what Thomas told me, it was several months earlier. He had pain in his right forearm, and he went to the VA, and they told him it was carpal tunnel, and they gave him a painkiller. He went back pretty quickly after that, and they diagnosed a blood clot, and they gave him a blood thinner. It was when the blood thinner, when the prescription for the blood thinner was stopped after 6 months, the embolism happened. Basically, the clot, you know, just moved, reformed, went to his lung and caused major damage, caused his brain to be without oxygen for a significant enough period where it put him into a coma and, affected the issues we talked about earlier, his motor skills and his memory and his speech.
Yeah, I think we need to take a little break here for a couple of messages. And when we come back, I'd like to pick it up at when he went to Chicago. This is Tom Clamer. You're listening to Tell Somebody, talking to Mark Wilkerson about his new biography, Thomas Young's War, coming out in just a couple of weeks. We'll be back right after you listen to this. You've been listening to the podcast edition of Tell Somebody. Tell Somebody podcasts are produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the broadcasts of Tell Somebody that have been heard on 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City.
Welcome back to Tell Somebody. This is Tom Clammer on the phone with Mark Wilkerson talking about his new book, Thomas Young's War. And Mark, before the break, we were talking about Thomas Young in the hospital at St. Luke's in Kansas City with embolism and a big setback. And he went off from there to a major rehab hospital in Chicago. Right. And that's where he met his second wife, right?
That's correct. There was there was a kind of a silver lining up there in Chicago. Claudia, his wife, that's where they met. Actually, it was Eddie Vedder again played a role. He was he did a solo concert up in Chicago in August of that year, and actually it was, you know, obviously he invited Thomas to the show, and it was, and Thomas was able to go. They took him, a couple of people from the rehab facility took him to the show for a real limited period of time, and that was his first venture out of the rehab facility, and he'd been there several months at that point. Claudia was reading she had seen Body of War back when it came out a few months earlier, and wanted to reach out to Thomas at that point because she was very moved by what she'd seen, and she'd been involved in the veterans community before with Vietnam veterans, but she couldn't figure out a way to get a hold of Thomas. And then she read a review of the Eddie Vedder show that August in Chicago and saw mention that Thomas was there and that he was at the rehab institute, and she called the rehab institute the next day and managed to get in touch with him. Actually, it was Ellen Spiro who filmed the majority of Body of War, was in Thomas's room at the time and answered the phone when Claudia called. So that's how they connected. Claudia began, she came and visited Thomas, and the visits became more and more frequent, and, you know, things kind of progressed from there. They wound up, you know, she wound up going back to Kansas City with him, and then a few years later, they got married.
A lot of us that hadn't managed to keep in close contact didn't really know about her till his letter came out, and she was right at his side in video interviews and pictures in the Kansas City Star. And really seemed to give him a lot of aid and comfort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he really, you know, obviously enjoyed spending time with her, and really appreciated everything that she did for him. And, you know, obviously she loved him very much and appreciated all the time she got to spend with him too. But, you know, that was one of the things when he started to kind of defer the decision to end his life in 2013. I remember he told me a few times that it was he wanted to see another season of baseball, and I'm not sure, I never really bought that excuse. But then he started saying that, you know, he wanted to spend more time with Claudia, and I found that a little more reasonable. So he, you know, he enjoyed the time he had with Claudia for sure.
Well, and if we were to take the baseball seriously, it's a damn shame he didn't get to see the World Series, I guess.
That's right, absolutely. Of course, that was on my mind when I saw that progress, and I'm sure it was on many other people's minds too that Thomas didn't get to see it.
You and I met at the memorial gathering for him in Kansas City just a few days after he died. Claudia was still in Seattle. Have you been in touch with her recently?
Yeah. Yeah, actually, I just got a letter from her yesterday in the mail. I've been in touch with Claudia, and, you know, with Kathy and with Nathan, Thomas's brother, and with Phil Donahue and Eddie Vedder and Ellen Spiro, a bunch of people that were around Thomas. But as far as Claudia, yeah, I talked to her a few days after we received the news that Thomas had died in November 2014. Which came as a total shock. You know, it wasn't something that he did on purpose. It was a complete surprise. He died in his sleep one night, actually, just by some strange coincidence, the evening before Veterans Day of 2014. But as you can imagine, Claudia was just distraught, beside herself, didn't know how to process. You know, I mean, you may think in some way that she had probably readied herself for that a million times, but I don't know if there is such a thing as readying yourself for that. So,
right.
You know, we're, what, a year and a half on now, and I don't know if things have gotten any easier or better for Claudia. So it's, I think it's difficult enough when you lose somebody in a normal lifespan or the normal evolution of somebody's life, but when you're very much a caregiver for that person around the clock for years on end and you never leave their side almost, you just imagine what that does, you know. So, I mean, Claudia and Thomas were together all the time. She didn't leave the house, especially towards the end. As you know, the few years that I was around, she didn't have a job outside the home or anything like that. It was her and Thomas together all the time, and that's all they had, you know. When I met Thomas, he was on a feeding tube already. Mm-hmm. So there was no going out to restaurants. There was none of that. I mean, he went out very little. They made plans to go out, and he'd get excited about going somewhere, but then he'd get in the chair and get in pain within a few minutes, and a lot of the plans they made never panned out. You know, speaking of the going out to restaurants, though, I mean, the last time I saw Thomas, he was excited because the doctor in Portland had was saying, you know, we're going to figure out a way to get you off the feeding tube. So he was really excited about that. He was talking about different kinds of food he wanted to try, and a lot of optimism and forward-looking there.
Yes, so many examples of optimism and hope looking forward and just over and over again just dashed and smashed.
Yeah.
It's just so sad. And yes. He was so strong through all of that.
Right. And like Phil said, there's a quote in the book that Phil said, he said throughout all of this, and I believe even though he announced that he wanted to end his life, Phil said, you know, throughout all of this, Thomas has wanted to live. He's come back from everything. And he did. He wanted to live. He always was optimistic and always figured out a way to make add humor into the most tragic and really heavy situations and uncomfortable situations, especially for somebody who's interviewing him. He'd find a way to, you know, inject humor into the situation. And I mean, the last time I saw him, he was trying to figure out a way to. The school system in Portland allowed counter-recruiting, and he wanted to go do counter-recruiting in the schools. But there was this, especially over the last few years, there was this tug-of-war there with these just enormous health issues where he just, you know, he found himself unable to go and do the things that he wanted to do because he had to focus on his own health.
Well, and as I've told you, I think that's why I think it's so good that this book is out, since he can't, even before he died, couldn't do this, and obviously can't now, but his story is very powerful in that regard. And this is coming out mid-April, is that right?
April the 12th. It's published by Haymarket Books. It'll be available in paperback and hardcover and ebook. With an amazing cover by Shepard Fairey, who also did the cover for the movie poster back in 2008, the Body of War film poster. And Shepard Fairey very kindly, very kindly donated the cover for this one. So my hope is that the inside of the book lives up to the outside of the book.
Well, it certainly does, in my opinion, and I hope... a lot of people will judge for themselves. And do you have a website? I mean, I'm sure it's available on Amazon and all the usual suspects too, right?
Yep. Haymarketbooks.org is the publisher's website. But yes, it'll be available. It's available. You can pre-order it or order it already on Haymarket's website or Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble. Anywhere books are sold, you can get it.
Thomas Young's War by Mark Wilkerson. Final thoughts for our listeners. Anything on your mind that we didn't get to that you'd like to put out there?
Really, I think, you know, the reason I did this was, you know, we've touched on it a few times, is this the importance of this story. It's a story about Thomas, who was a really likable, charismatic kid who had a very unique set of circumstances happen to him. I mean, that's an important enough story for sure, but in a broader sense, this war that I talk about in the title, Thomas's War, it began on the day that he was shot, and it lasted for 10 years. It was the war that he fought when he got home, and it was all of the struggles, the daily struggles for comfort and meaning in his life, to be pain-free, to have some normal relationships and try and have some normalcy back in his life, that I think thousands upon thousands of our veterans deal with and are still dealing with. We've put 2.5 million of our fellow citizens through that, you know, based on these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we're paying more attention to the post-war stories, but still not enough. And this is one, and maybe this will make people, or help people understand a little bit of the difficulties and the struggles that our veterans are going through when they return home, because we seem to take our focus off them once they're back home.
That sadly does seem to be the case. Well, I guess we'll leave it about at that. Mark Wilkerson, author of Thomas Young's War, coming out next month, published by Haymarket Books. Thank you very much for spending some time with us today on Tell Somebody.
Tom, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Well, that's it. We're out of time for this show and for the weekly edition of Tell Somebody. Do keep an eye on www.tellsomebody.us. I am far behind on posting podcasts, but do intend to catch up, and also intend to post new podcasts of all the interviews I have with Thomas Young and his mother Kathy Smith, and with Body of War filmmakers Phil Donahue and Ellen Spiro, so you can find them all in one place. I am very sorry to have to end the weekly show, but I'm keeping the blog site and podcasting going and hope to do an occasional show if and when I have the time and make them available to KKFI and to Pacifica affiliates if they care to air them. I'd like to thank everyone who's supported the show over the last 10 years, and at risk of leaving off some important names, would like to single out a few, especially my old pal Mike Murphy, along with Jeff Humfeld, Niloufar Movahedi, and to Jen Zaman for posting the upcoming shows on the KKFI website for the last year or two, and a special nod to Judy Ansel in the Heartland Labor Forum, who gave me and many others an entree and opportunity to get on the air. Despite the wonderful work of those folks and many others, I am concerned about the future direction of the station. We need people like you to think about getting more involved in your community radio station. Show up to some board and committee meetings and get a feel for things. These meetings should be posted on the KKFI.org website. If you can't find them, call 816-931-3122 during business hours and ask about the meetings. It would, of course, have been arrogant and foolish to suppose that one little radio show on one community radio station could have by itself dramatically changed the world. But even trying to adjust expectations to a thoroughly realistic level, I can't help but feel the show has been a failure. There are things, maybe many of them small, but still important things, that can be done by ordinary people in the face of an urgent need for things to be done. And, by and large, we aren't doing them. Not enough, anyway. Despite impressive work by a lot of wonderful people in a lot of wonderful groups, we are still too much in silos. We have an urgent need for major change, and I believe that looking at how to be the most effective leads to the conclusion that all those in silos, they need to keep doing their individual work, but while doing it, need to join together better in fixing media and journalism failures and in fighting against corporate rights and money in politics and government much more effectively than we have been. I think it is possible. This is Tom Clammer. Send me an email, mail@tellsomebody.us. Keep an eye on www.tellsomebody.us. The Facebook page, facebook.com/tellsomebody now.
Follow me on Twitter, @TellSomebody. Now, I hope to see you around.